Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're cutting through a lot of the noise to get to what our source material calls a fundamental constitutional conflict. And it's one that's being really misunderstood in the public conversation. When you hear about federal immigration enforcement, the conversation usually goes straight to border security or immigration policy. But we're going much deeper. We're looking at a core constitutional question. Can executive agencies, we're talking specifically about immigration enforcement here, legally act as general domestic police forces, you know, thousands of miles inside the United States?
And that geographic point is everything. It's the whole ball game. What the research really hammers home is that these controversial, sometimes fatal encounters we're all reading about, they're almost never happening right at the border wall. They're happening deep inside the country, in city parks, residential neighborhoods, workplaces. And when enforcement happens there, federal agents have to play by the exact same Fourth Amendment rules as your local police department.
Okay, so if the rules are supposed to be the same, why do we see these constant conflicts? It feels like something is structurally broken. And the material we reviewed points to four sort of pillars of this crisis. First, there's the absence of a judge in the process. Then there's this weird lack of transparent ID for agents, a lack of actual legal basis for some of their powers, and finally, a system that just seems to crush accountability when force gets used.
Exactly. And to really get why accountability is failing, you have to start with the authority the agents think they have. It goes back to the legal definition of their mission. So at its core, federal immigration enforcement, the whole removal process, it's legally defined as a civil regulatory regime. It is not, and this is key, a criminal policing mandate. A person in removal proceedings is in a civil process, not a criminal one. And that matters because the civil track just doesn't have the same safeguards, you know, like an appointed lawyer or proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Wait, okay. If the Fourth Amendment applies fully inside the country, how can a document signed by the agency itself get around a judge? I thought that was the entire point of the warrant clause in the Constitution.
It absolutely is. And this is where the administrative warrant becomes a huge fault line. When you or I hear the word warrant, we think of a judicial warrant, you know, a document signed by a neutral, impartial magistrate, a real judge based on probable cause. That judge is the constitutional check on executive power.
But what the sources say is that in these interior operations, what's often being used is an administrative warrant.
Correct. And that's just an internal executive document. It's signed by an agency official, maybe a supervisor. It has zero finding of probable cause from a neutral judge. It's just the agency giving itself permission.
So the result of using these internal documents in places like Chicago or Phoenix or rural North Carolina is, well, it's literally policing without judges. And that must put this incredible stress on the constitutional line between civil power and criminal power.
It's immense stress. And it's made worse because agents often act like this broad border authority. They have just sort of travels with them deep into the country. And the sources are clear that it just doesn't. Legally, it doesn't. Once they leave that defined border zone, which is at most 100 air miles, they have to follow the same rules as the local beat cop. Period.
That's fascinating, because if they're governed by local cop rules, then the agency can't just invent its own powers through like an internal memo.
Precisely. And one of the biggest warnings in the material is against this idea of constitutional inversion. That's where an agency looks at a law, sees that it's silent on something, and treats that silence as permission.
So because Congress didn't explicitly forbid something, they assume they can do it.
Exactly. So like stopping someone just on a hunch or demanding ID from everyone, federal power has to flow from Congress. The absence of a no is not the same as a yes.
Okay, that really sets the stage for how these encounters begin, often on very shaky legal ground or with no judicial authority at all. So let's pivot to what happens when they go wrong. This brings us to a huge Supreme Court case from 2025, Barnes v. Felix.
Barnes is a total game changer. It basically killed off a really flawed legal doctrine that courts had been using for years. It was called the moment of threat analysis.
Which sounds like a legal form of tunnel vision.
That's the perfect way to put it.
Yeah.
It was. It reduced the entire constitutional question down to a single snapshot. A court would literally freeze the frame at the exact moment an officer used force and ignore everything that came before.
So it allowed them to just whitewash any bad decisions or, crucially, an illegal stop that created the threat to begin with.
Yes. And the sources have this brilliant phrase for what the Supreme Court did. They call it the rejection of chronological amnesia. Such a powerful way to say it. The system used to let officers just hit a reset button right before the force happened.
So what does Barnes demand that they do now?
The Supreme Court was unanimous on this. It wasn't even close. Barnes said that to figure out if force was reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, you have to look at the totality of the circumstances. That means the entire sequence of events, the tactical choices, the legal reason for the stop in the first place, the escalation, all of it. It put causation back into the heart of the analysis.
That feels like a massive shift in liability. The idea that you can't just sever the final act from everything you did to create that situation.
It is. The court was incredibly clear. An officer cannot recklessly or deliberately create the conditions of necessity by, say, starting an illegal stop or using risky tactics and then turn around and invoke that necessity to justify their use of force. Self-created danger, in the court's view, is a constitutional failure.
Let's make this really concrete for people listening. Say an agent deep in the interior pulls over a car just because the driver looks nervous. That stop is illegal, right? It lacks suspicion.
You're right.
Then the driver panics, tries to run, and the agent tackles them. Before Barnes, a court might have just looked at the moment the driver resisted.
Exactly right. The old thinking was, well, the driver resisted, so the force was justified. But now, under Barnes, the court has to rewind the tape. It has to ask, was that initial stop legal? And since it wasn't, every use of force that follows is tainted by that original illegality. The illegal start is what caused the whole confrontation.
And the sources are really clear. This isn't just about shootings.
Not at all. Barnes was a deadly force case. But the principle applies across the board, to investigatory stops, to searches, to threats, to non-lethal force. This is so important for interior enforcement because so many of these encounters start with these low-level but still unlawful actions.
Okay, so now we have to take that Barnes framework looking at the whole story and apply it to what's actually happening on the ground. Mm. The material highlights two huge problems, wanton force and coercive ID demands.
Let's start with the physical conduct. The section on wanton force and intimidation is pretty sobering. You have to remember, the Fourth Amendment regulates conduct. A seizure happens anytime a person's liberty is restrained. It doesn't require an arrest. This includes an agent pushing someone, grabbing their arm, shoving them aside, blocking a car, or even just standing in a doorway to block an exit.
And those are all physical seizures. They all require legal justification, but they're happening outside of a formal arrest.
That's the key. Just because you don't use handcuffs doesn't mean it wasn't a seizure. When agents use physical force like that, aggressively grabbing a phone from someone who's recording or physically blocking their path, they're executing a seizure. And that act has to be justified by suspicion or a judicial warrant. If they don't have that, the encounter was illegal from the very start.
And on that note of identifying who's even doing this, the material points out that masked enforcement has become pretty normalized. That has to make it almost impossible for the public to know if the authority is legitimate.
It absolutely erodes that ability. And that's another constitutional problem. If an agent isn't clearly identifiable, if they're wearing a mask, driving an unmarked car, you as a civilian have no way to know if this is lawful authority or something else entirely. And we see documented cases of people being threatened or physically restrained just for observing or recording. That's a seizure, and it has to be justified.
Then there's the whole issue of demanding ID, which seems to be a go-to tactic.
The material's crystal clear here. This is under the section on unlawful stops and identification demands. Away from the border, federal agents are bound by the Terry v. Ohio standard. That means they need specific, reasonable suspicion that a crime is happening.
And if they don't have that specific suspicion, that Terry predicate, what obligation do I have to show my ID?
Pretty much none. The sources stress there is no general legal duty to carry or produce ID in the United States unless you're part of a valid stop and a specific state law requires it, which is rare. So when agents just walk up and demand ID or conduct these stop-and-frisk-style seizures without that legal basis, they are committing a constitutional violation right at the start, at the moment of initiation.
And under Barnes, that illegal start can't be forgotten. If an agent makes an illegal demand for ID and things escalate from there, that initial illegality taints everything that follows. It's all connected.
It connects directly. And this brings us to the question of institutional knowledge. The agencies can't just say, oops, our agent made a mistake. The source material points to a bombshell piece of evidence here. The 2013 Police Executive Research Forum report, the PRF report.
And this wasn't some outside group criticizing them. This was a report commissioned by the agency itself.
By CBP, yes, after a string of controversial shootings. And it was basically an institutional roadmap of their own failures.
What does it find?
It warned them, in no uncertain terms, that their agents were too often creating the very threats they later used to justify deadly force. It pointed to specific tactical failures. standing too close to cars, escalating way too quickly, failing to back off when things got heated. They were using confrontational tactics that predictably made things worse, not better.
This PERF report detail seems absolutely crucial for accountability, doesn't it? It basically removes their ability to claim it was just an unforeseeable accident.
That's it, exactly. This kind of institutional notice destroys plausible deniability. When your own report warns you that tactic A reliably leads to deadly outcomes and you keep training and using tactic A, you can't then claim a deadly outcome was a surprise. They knew the risks.
So you have the legal rule from Barnes, don't create the necessity for force, and you have the PERF report providing the factual proof that they knew their tactics were doing just that. It reframes these incidents not as tragedies, but as foreseeable failures to comply with their own warnings and the Constitution.
That's the whole picture on the scrutiny side. But here's the paradox. This is a major tension in the source material. While Barnes is making courts look at the whole story, other Supreme Court decisions, like the Egbert line of cases, have been doing the opposite. They've been severely narrowing the Bivens remedy.
Okay, let's break that down. What is Bivens, and what does narrowing it mean for a person whose rights were violated by a federal agent?
Well, historically, Bivens was the way you could sue an individual federal officer for money damages if they violated your constitutional rights. But the Supreme Court has been slamming that door shut case by case. It's now almost impossible to bring a Bivens claim in a new context. So you have this strange situation where the constitutional scrutiny is getting wider, but a key tool for holding the individual officer accountable is disappearing.
That sounds like it creates an accountability black hole. If you can't sue the officer, what happens? Where does the remedy go?
The accountability reallocates. It shifts. As the door closes on Bivens, another one becomes more important, the Federal Tort Claims Act, or FTCA. Now, with the FTCA, you're not suing the officer personally. You're suing the U.S. government itself. And crucially, these FTCA claims use state tort law things like negligence, battery, wrongful death. And those state laws often have much clearer rules about conduct than the broad constitutional standard.
So it shifts the whole legal battlefield. But does a lawsuit under the FTCA still force a court to look at the whole timeline, like Barnes demands?
It does, and maybe even more so. State negligence law is all about causation and foreseeability. If an agent negligently and illegally starts an encounter, and that action directly leads to a foreseeable injury, the government can be held liable under the FTCA. And look, closing the Bivens door for civil suits doesn't make criminal exposure go away. That necessity defense for using force looks really, really weak when the whole thing started with an illegal stop, especially when the PERF report warned them this would happen.
And the sources note, this whole unstable situation is made worse by cases like Noem v. Bosquez Perdomo, which basically lets these aggressive interior tactics continue while the courts are still trying to figure out if they're even legal.
It just lets that structural fault line keep cracking. Accountability gets kicked down the road, pushed into these different legal channels like the FTCA or criminal review, which then have to sort through these incredibly messy and tragic chronologies.
This has been a really critical dive. We've seen how the whole constitutional analysis is shifting toward looking at the full story at causation. The big takeaway seems to be structural. When you unmoor administrative power from a judge's oversight, it's just going to crash into the Fourth Amendment, and the failure is foreseeable.
Right. What the material warns, again and again, is that we have a system that lets aggressive interior enforcement roll on, while accountability is always something that happens later, if at all. That gap between the immediate use of power and the distant check of a court, that is the constitutional fault line.
And that leaves us with the final, pretty provocative thought from the sources. Administrative power without a real-time judicial check is not a stable system for a democracy. The question is, will the executive agencies choose to respect that line between law and power on their own? Or will they force the courts to draw it for them all over again at an even greater cost to everyone's liberty and safety? Thank you for joining us for the deep dive. We hope this gave you a clear shortcut to understanding this really critical and fast-evolving constitutional fight.